The following is an encore presentation of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, so no phone calls will be taken.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, July 15th, 2012, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today's show is one I've been looking forward to for a long time, as I know many of you have. We have live on the air for the full hour, Noam Chomsky joining us from Massachusetts. It's going to be a great hour talking about politics and our times and anything you want to talk about on our phone lines. So join us, but before we go to Noam Chomsky, let's go to the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. It's now 5 weeks before the presidential election. Democrats criticized Mitt Romney for not providing more details on his tax plan. For example, which loopholes would he want to close? His running mate Paul Ryan was asked about that on Fox News Sunday this morning. He said it would take too long to go through the math, but he said he and Romney would start by closing loopholes for high-income Americans. Ryan also said the Republicans are providing a clear choice.
The president is trying to paper over his problems. The president has been trying to mislead and distort the record. It's a failed record. We think it was very important to point that out.
Ryan said the race is close and he expects it to stay that way until Election Day. Tomorrow is the first Monday in October, and that means it's the opening day of a new Supreme Court term. NPR's Nina Totenberg has this preview.
It would be hard to beat the cataclysmic, cacophonous end of last term and the historic decision upholding the Obama health care law. But this term will almost certainly make banner headlines, too. Although the court has twice before ruled that state colleges and universities can use race as one of many factors in admissions decisions, a new conservative court majority has decided to revisit the issue. Likewise, it is expected to turn a skeptical eye on the voting rights law, even though it upheld the act just 3 years ago. But perhaps the most emotional decision facing the court is gay marriage and whether the 1996 federal law defining marriage as between a man and a woman amounts to unconstitutional discrimination. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The city of Chicago wants residents to share their ideas on how to get illegal guns off the streets by using Twitter. NPR's Cheryl Corley has more.
Crime is down in Chicago, but homicides are up sharply from a year ago. By mid-September of this year, 382 people, many of them teens, were killed, and most of those deaths involved guns. The push to have residents tweet suggestions about how to get illegal guns off the street in the country's third largest city is part of an annual forum called Ideas Week, and people have been tweeting to hashtag WhatIfChicago. Some of their proposed solutions include more police officers and keeping gyms open at schools and churches to give young people alternative places to go. Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy will be on hand for a debate on the ideas as the city looks to add new strategies to its efforts to fight gun violence. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
Several bombs exploded in Shiite neighborhoods in Iraq today. Officials say at least 26 people were killed. The deadliest attack occurred in a town just north of Baghdad. Authorities say three cars exploded within minutes of each other, killing eight people. No one has claimed responsibility for any of the bombings, but authorities note that the Sunni militants al-Qaeda in Iraq often use car bombs. This is NPR News from Washington.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today needs no introduction. He's been on the show many times before, and it is always a great honor to welcome him back. Noam Chomsky, professor at MIT, based in Massachusetts, is one of the leading political commentators and linguists in the world. Noam, welcome back to Media Matters.
Pleased to be with you again.
You know, Noam, you have been around a while, as have I, but you lapped me a few times. And we have a whole new generation of young people now becoming aware of your writings on politics and media, but especially politics. And I think you've got a new generation of people interested in your work. And what I'd like, for some of those who might be listening, maybe a little bit about your background, how you came of age and where you got your politics. I think that'd be a nice setup for our discussion of contemporary issues.
Well, I actually grew up in the Great Depression as a child, and I'm old enough to remember it. My family was mostly unemployed working class, very politically active, and quite a high level of culture, including high culture, which was not unusual among in working class circles of the day. There was a lot of, as a child, early childhood experiences were, in fact, of some of the depths of the Depression. People coming to the door trying to sell rags, strikers being attacked by security forces, plenty of very visible misery. Objectively, it was much worse than today, of course. It was a much poorer country. However, there was, after the first few years, say by the mid-30s, there was a clear sense of hopefulness and anticipation, a sense that somehow it's going to work out. We'll get out of this together. There was a lot of the New Deal legislation was beginning to have effects, significant effects. There was a very substantial and militant labor organizing, which was at the forefront of most of what was happening. CIO was being organized, was moving on to quite militant tactics like sit-down strikes, which are very threatening to the business classes. They're just a step before taking over a factory. In general, the atmosphere was one of a very lively debate and discussion. Every imaginable left faction that had a voice was you could find them on the newsstands, in the secondhand bookstores, libraries, on the streets, places where I'd hang out as a young teenager later. So it was just immersed in an atmosphere of very lively politics, very extremely serious issues coming. The rise of fascism in Europe was quite frightening. Actually, the first political article I can remember writing was, I can easily date, it was right after the fall of Barcelona in February 1939, and it was about the specter of fascism expanding over Europe. I'm sure it was not a very memorable article.
Well, you were 10 years old.
Yeah, I was a kid, but I was following it pretty closely.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And it wasn't, it was, I wouldn't say it was usual. In fact, I can't remember anyone else who did, but it wasn't that unusual. It was part of the atmosphere. By a year or two later, when I lived in Philadelphia, when I was old enough to go to New York by myself, stay with my relatives, mostly working class relatives, I'd spent a lot of time on down, it's not there anymore, but on 4th Avenue, right below Union Square, there was a string of bookstores, secondhand bookstores, mostly run by emigres, recent emigres, people who fled fascism. A lot of them were from the Spanish Civil anarchists and other leftists fleeing from the Spanish Civil War. And there were also meeting places and offices of left organizations, like the left, the anarchist Freie Arbeiterstimme had its offices in Union Square. I'd hang around there, and I just picked up a lot of kind of informal education from that, as well as from family members and just general circles. By the time I was 14 or 15, I'd often spend Saturday afternoon in the Philadelphia Public Library, which for whatever reason had a very rich collection of radical journals of every imaginable stripe. So it was just part of childhood. You know, I can't say when it started.
Our guest today, Noam Chomsky. This is live on WILL AM 580. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. The phone lines are open. We welcome your phone calls for Professor Chomsky. The number here.
This is a rebroadcast of a previous Media Matters program, so no phone calls will be taken.
9455. We're going to be talking about politics, of course, for most of the hour. U.S. foreign policy, what's going on in the world today, political economy, and whatever you'd like to talk to. Noam, we have someone who called in right at the beginning of the show from the Big Island in Hawaii. So we've got someone listening online. Let's go to line four right now. Hawaii, you're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Hello, thank you. Professor Chomsky, recently you've made some comments to the effect that if the petroleum optimists are right, or in their notion that there would be 100 years more of petroleum, it could only lead to more degradation or exploit. Pardon me for paraphrasing, but what I'm getting at is Ivan Illich was a philosopher and teacher who's been pretty marginalized for various reasons, but in the mid-70s he wrote an essay entitled Energy and Equity, and in it he stated that regardless of the source or availability of energy, that the actual quanta beyond a certain threshold leads to inequities through what he termed radical monopolies. And he, I don't know, an obvious example might be, say, the Concorde supersonic jet. And regardless of how that thing's going to be powered, it necessarily leads to other people having to deal with the effects of being immobilized through that, or more ubiquitously, the automobile and its effect on people that might choose to try and live outside of that paradigm. And now here we're in the midst of internet technology, and one wonders how that applies. So I'm wondering if you're familiar with Illich's work, and particularly the idea expressed in that essay, Energy and Equity, and if you think any of that is valid, what political or educational climate would lead to a greater recognition or awareness of this relationship that Illich was speaking to. It seems to me that in protest politics or Occupy Wall Street, if people are still talking about the wonders of that magic battery or the free energy that's going to happen and change this, that they certainly wouldn't be aware of this, and then we'd have a foundational error and so on. So I just wanted to hear your comments regarding that, and I thank you much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Noam Chomsky?
Well, I knew Illich a bit, and I think his work was very important, including on this issue. But by now, in fact, even beginning by then, it was, in my opinion, swamped by a far more serious potential catastrophe in this domain, way beyond problems of inequity. So, in fact, right in the early 70s, personal friends of mine who were leading scientists, head of the Earth Science Department at Harvard, head of the meteorology program at MIT, I'm at Cambridge, so knew both of them, both personal friends, and they, you know, very prominent scientists, began to talk pretty much privately at that time about information that was coming along that they regarded as extremely threatening, that if it turned out to be, if it was authenticated and supported by further research, it would predict catastrophic consequences for the planet and for human life. Well, unfortunately, since then, a lot of their fears have turned out to be justified. The talk about 100 years of free access to fossil fuels, which is now pretty common, you know, thanks to advanced extraction techniques, fracking and so on, maybe leading to energy independence for the United States for a century. That was a theme of President Obama's State of the Union address. There are euphoric articles in the business press about it and elsewhere. There's a question that goes unanswered in those excited presentations. There's some talk occasionally about the local, very harmful local effects of these sophisticated extraction techniques. But a deeper question is, what kind of world will there be if we proceed to use fossil fuels without restraint for a century? In fact, we're already reaching what may turn out to be a tipping point where there's no recovery. These are concerns that go far beyond those that Illich brought up in the 70s, even though his were, in fact, valid. We can't put this off much longer. We're kind of like lemmings walking off a cliff. I mean, there is debate about it, like, you know, nothing's certain in the world, but certainly in complex matters like this. But I think there's pretty overwhelming scientific evidence that something very serious is underway. There are two groups of dissenters. One of them gets a lot of publicity in the press, a very small group of scientists and some others who think that the concerns are overblown. There's a much larger group of highly qualified scientists who are also dissenters. They don't accept the international consensus, the IPCC conclusions, but that's because they think they're way too conservative and that the actual situation is much more dire than the scientific consensus suspects. They barely get any mention in the media. What's happening right, if you want to think about what's happening now, just take a look at the Rio Plus 20 conference that just took place. There was an international conference in Rio a couple of weeks ago. It's Plus 20 because it's 20 years after the first Rio conference, which led to international agreements on doing something about global warming. Nothing very serious, but at least something. Now it's 20 years later. The conference opened with very low aspirations. Nothing was expected from it. And the outcome was derisory, almost nothing. There's one group in the world, one easily identifiable group in the world, a significant one, that's pressing very hard to do something serious about this topic. That's the indigenous communities, and in the countries where they are influential, something is really being done. So there's one country in which the indigenous population is actually a majority, and they succeeded in taking political power in the last decade. That's Bolivia, the poorest country in South America, and they're in the lead internationally in pressing for significant action to face this potential catastrophe. In fact, there's now in Bolivia and in Ecuador, the other country with a substantial and influential indigenous population, in those two countries, there's now legislation, in fact, constitutional initiatives to insist upon what they call the rights of nature. That is, nature itself has rights. That's a very substantial feature of traditional societies. It also was of Western societies, if you go back far enough. So if you go back to, say, the famous Magna Carta, it actually had two elements. One was the Charter of Liberties, which people sort of know about. The other was called the Charter of the Forest. That was a call to preserve what were called the commons, the source of sustenance, energy, food, construction for the common people, for the general population. And part of them, and that was not wilderness, what they called forest, was carefully cultivated. It was common property. It was nurtured and developed by the general population for their own use and for future generations. Now, that kind of sensibility still exists in indigenous societies. And unfortunately, in the case of the Charter of the Forest, by about the 17th century, it had pretty much disappeared under the impact of capitalist development, which introduced the conception that that nothing has any value unless it's owned. There's now a common idea. It's called the tragedy of the commons. The idea is that if something's held in common, it's just going to be destroyed because people working together for common interest and for the sake of their children can't do anything but destroy. That's capitalist morality. There isn't absolutely nothing to it. In fact, it's almost the opposite. But that's pervasive. Therefore, everything has to be owned. Everything has to be privatized. And, in fact, by the logic of capitalist accumulation, in fact, destroyed.
You know, Noam, by going back to the point of departure for your answer there, I'd like to follow up. And this is not meant to be a rhetorical question, but I suspect it will sound that way. If, as in The Economist, which you alluded to, the business press, they have a huge cover story in their most recent edition announcing that this energy revolution, the fracking, is going to, give American capitalism global leadership and dynamism for the next several decades. If, in fact, this is the one way capitalism can sort of get back to being remotely credible as an economic system, or more credible as an economic system, what does it say about capitalism?
It says that something that should have been understood since the 17th century, when these developments began to take place, that capitalism is a suicide pact. The Economist is repeating what has been, in fact, in the leading business press for some time. So, for example, it must have been about 6 months ago, the London Financial Times, which one of the best newspapers in the world, the most responsible, had a full-page story on a very enthusiastic story about the possibility, the likelihood, they thought, that the United States would have energy independence for 100 years, and that would also preserve U.S. hegemony. Now, they didn't talk about capitalism. It's a word that's not used, but what it meant is that the U.S. version of state capitalism could maintain dominance over the world, not just in the United States, for a century. Now, they did discuss some of the local consequences of fracking. They have very harm. It has, these techniques have very harmful local effects: destroy water supplies, massive pollution, much else. But they did not even raise the question: what's the world going to look like if we can even make it through 100 years of exploitation, free exploitation of fossil fuels? And the evidence on that is our grandchildren and great-grandchildren will have to face a pretty miserable future.
Our guest is Noam Chomsky. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open here.
This is a rebroadcast of a previous Media Matters program, so no phone calls will be taken.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Coles County, you're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Yes, I've followed these matters pretty closely for over 60 years, and it seems to me that today and in recent years in the United States, the left is in a very anemic condition. By the left, I mean not only the socialist left and what might be called the ultra-left, but also even the old-fashioned, just regular liberal left and the Democratic Party left. It's a very anemic condition, and I guess I could say that, to me, the left has pretty much left the room or left the building. And, of course, young people, the great majority of young people, aren't interested in public affairs. They don't vote, not interested in voting, and they're not interested in protesting either. What is your view on this?
Thank you very much, caller. Noam Chomsky?
Well, my own feeling, frankly, is that if you count noses, there's more activism among young people and more concern about broad issues of the kind that you and I are discussing than there has been almost ever in the past, except maybe for a very brief moment at the end of the 1960s. There was a period of 2 or 3 years in the late 60s when there was intensive engagement in political activism of many kinds, most of it pretty narrowly focused at the time on the fantastic atrocities of the Indochina wars, which were reaching the point of obscenity. But apart from that, I think there's, in general now, I think there's a good deal more commitment and concern, maybe more than ever. It's fractured, you know, it's atomized, like almost everything in the country. So there's very little in the way of integration, and although to some extent it began to take shape with the Occupy movements, which themselves are pretty new. There was never anything like that. As far as voting is concerned, remember that in 2008, which is not that long ago, there was a huge upsurge in voting, electoral enthusiasm, activism, organizing, for political organizing among young people. Now, it's not true now, but it's not because they've abandoned politics. It's because they've become deeply disillusioned by the collapse of what they believed incorrectly was the promise of Obama. And that had a deeply disillusioning effect, not just among young people, among working people, labor unions, others, women, and so on. And yeah, that's cut back a direct political, in the narrow sense, political activism. On the other hand, many other things are happening that I think are pretty encouraging. So take the Occupy movement. If you'd asked me a year ago, is there any hope in setting up a public space in Zuccotti Park in New York, I would have laughed. I would have thought it's a joke. Can't be done. Well, it turned out to be extremely successful strategy this is last September. Within a couple of weeks, there were Occupy movements spreading all over the country, actually thousands of them, in fact, all over the world, with an enormous number of people involved. And in just a few months, which is a very brief time, they had a considerable impact on public perceptions, on public discourse, and on and for the participants themselves. Now, it's much too early to know where a popular movement can go. It's, after all, literally only a few months. But the impact was quite significant, and I think it revealed a latent activism, latent sense of activism that's just waiting to be stirred up, and can be if there's enough enterprise and engagement. And one can never predict these things. So take, for example, the civil rights movement, you know, the last kind of major lasting popular movement. Its roots go far back. But it really took off in the early 1960s, again, with a few simple actions that had consequences that surprised the participants and everyone else as well. For example, in 1960, a couple of students from a black college sat in at a lunch counter, Woolworth lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, asking to be served. Want a cup of coffee. Doesn't sound like a very radical action. They were, of course, arrested, treated pretty harshly, sent off. That could have well been the end of it, except that others came right away and made the same demands. Pretty soon you had the formation of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which really spearheaded the civil rights movement, Freedom Riders, Mississippi Summer, ultimately a mass popular movement, which did lead to significant legislation and large-scale changes in the country. It's one of the developments in the 1960s that really civilized the country in many ways. Now, of course, it had its limits, and it's worth looking at the lessons. So take, say, Martin Luther King, a very significant figure. He became the spokesperson for the rising civil rights movement. Every January on Martin Luther King Day, there was impressive oratory about King's contributions and his courage and that he demonstrated and his achievements. But almost all of it ends in 1963 with his famous I Have a Dream speech. Well, Martin Luther King didn't close up shop and go home in 1963. In fact, he went on. And what happened when he went on is highly instructive. Right at that point, King went on to try to confront two major issues. One was the Vietnam War, then already expanding into a major atrocity. And the other was class issues. He began efforts to try to organize what became a movement of the poor. In fact, he had another I Have a Dream Day, which is rarely mentioned, but in my opinion is more important. It was in 1968, the evening when he was assassinated. Right before the assassination, he did give a memorable address. This was in Memphis, Tennessee. He was there to support a strike of public workers, sanitation workers, and he was just on the way. It was the first step that was going to proceed to a march on Washington to try to establish a movement of the poor and to gain legislation that would deal with the fundamental problems of the poor and of poverty in the country, which are not, there is a correlation to race, but it's much broader than that. Well, his speech there, with his usual biblical rhetoric, described how he felt like Moses, who could see the promised land across the River Jordan, but knew that he himself was never going to get there, although you, his audience, the poor people of the country, the persecuted, repressed people of the country, you'll get there, but it's going to be a struggle. And shortly after that, he was assassinated. The march took place. It was led by Coretta King, his widow, started from the motel where he was assassinated in Memphis. It went through the major centers of the South, Birmingham, Selma, other places where there had been dramatic and often quite brutal confrontations, did get to Washington. When they got to Washington, they sent up, the marchers set up a tent city. It's called Resurrection City. It didn't last long. In the middle of the night, security forces were sent, incidentally sent by the most liberal Congress in American history, to destroy the tent city and to drive the marchers out of town. Well, that was the end of that initiative. And in fact, that whole period from 1964 up through 68 is pretty much wiped out of the recollections of King's contributions. That's the people who own history shape it their own way, but we should shape it a different way. What he was doing then was extremely significant. And in fact, when you bring up significant class issues and you move on to the North, going beyond racist Alabama sheriffs, then problems become very serious and extremely difficult. As you recall, I'm sure his major organizing efforts were in Chicago, not far from you, and they were just lambasted. He was trying to deal with problems of urban poverty and repression, and he couldn't break through the northern liberal establishment. Well, those problems still very much exist. The Occupy movement has an opportunity to confront them, and my predictions would have been totally wrong a year ago, and I don't trust them today, but it's at least an opportunity, and it shouldn't be abandoned.
Our guest, Noam Chomsky. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580 Radio. It's a live show coming to you today. So the lines are open at 217-333-9455, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. We've got a lot of callers, so I'm going to turn the show over to them as much as possible to give you an opportunity to speak directly with Professor Chomsky. Let's go to line one, Champaign County, right now. You're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Hi, I'm glad to make it this time. The last time you were on, I was going to bring up the Sydney Peace Prize Award and congratulate you for it and the three major addresses you gave at that time that I circulated on community media here and made the routes. But I Google News searched Sydney Peace Prize Chomsky at the time, and I got three hits, one from the Sydney Herald and two from ABC Online. I can still remember it to this time. There was no response to it at all, not even in the European press, and there was a bit of a controversy because they gave the Edward Said lecture as one of those three, I believe, in Perth. But so I just want to know if you're still, you know, this may be a little too personalist for you, but I'm sure you can generalize on it, whether when you go to Madrid and other European capitals particularly, you get interviewed like you always had in the past, and you feel like you're having the same effect, or has the limits of allowable debate and the discourse gotten so neoliberal, even when there are somewhat left parties, that you feel like you still have the impact, even though you obviously don't get called to Nightline here?
Thank you very much, caller. Professor Chomsky?
Well, the media here at... to a large extent in Europe, are pretty selective on who they're willing to offer a voice to. This Sydney Peace Prize was, of course, in Australia, and there was plenty of coverage there, huge crowds, other conferences, which I don't recall if they were reported in the Sydney Opera Hall, with thousands of people showing up, also in Melbourne and Adelaide. And, you know, it's not that different here. It's just that it doesn't get to the elite media. So, in fact, I'm just every day, if I go through my hundreds of email letters, a couple of dozen of them are invitations to give talks. I can't deal with a fraction of them, unfortunately, but I do what I can. And increasingly, there are audiences which are not only huge, but enthusiastic and engaged, far beyond anything that happened in the past, except for that brief moment around the late 60s. And that's true everywhere in the country. Arizona, you know, Idaho, Central Florida, wherever it might be. There's a lot of interest and concern out there. In fact, there's a kind of a unfortunate supply-demand lack of inadequacy. A lot of demand, very little supply, and that just means there's a lot that can be done. Whether it's in the major media or not, you know, it doesn't matter that much. Can reach people in all sorts of other ways.
Noam Chomsky, you've written throughout your career on American foreign policy, the United States' role in the world, and it's probably been some of your most important political writing throughout your career. And I was wondering, some of your recent essays have been on the decline of the United States, of the American empire, and I suspect to a lot of Americans who've never really been exposed to your work or to critical work, who only have U.S. news media and American politicians understand the role in the world, the very idea of an American empire is sort of a bizarre one that's antithetical to what they've been taught. So maybe you could just talk about what you mean by America being an empire, and then why is it in decline?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. The founding fathers had no problem with it. They spoke, frankly, of their plans to develop an American empire, beginning with the eastern seaboard of the United States and maybe extending over the whole hemisphere, as Thomas Jefferson hoped. Of course, it would be an empire of freedom and so on, but you know, every imperial system has rhetoric like that. The conquest of the national territory was imperial conquest. One of the leading historians, academic historians of imperialism, Bernard Porter, a British historian, pointed out once that we shouldn't succumb to what he called the salt water fallacy, that domination and control and annexation only become imperial if you cross salt water. So, for example, if the Mississippi had been as wide as the Irish Sea, we'd call the conquest of the West imperialism. But it's the same phenomenon whether it crosses salt water or not. The conquest of the national territory involved elimination, virtual elimination of the indigenous population, millions of people. That's what the founding fathers called extermination they didn't mince words, by methods of merciless and perfidious cruelty, describing what they were doing. That was one part of the imperial conquest. The Southwest and West United States are half of Mexico. In fact, last time I talked in Arizona a couple of months ago, I just referred to Arizona as occupied Mexico, which is to a lot of applause, I should say. But that's all imperialism. By the end of the 19th century, the U.S. had reached its territorial limits, not because those were the limits of aspiration, but because they couldn't go any farther. Starting in the, right at the time of the American Revolution, there were efforts and initiatives to try to conquer Canada, and that continued right through the 19th century. It was beaten back by British force. Cuba was regarded as a crucial part of the American Empire back from the early 19th century, but again, couldn't be conquered because of the British deterrent. Finally, the national territorial limits, what's called the territorial limits, were reached by around 1898 or so. But that didn't end it. Then the United States just went on beyond. That already included Alaska. That included 1898 was the takeover of effective conquest of Cuba. It's called the liberation of Cuba. In fact, it was the prevention of Cuba's liberation from Spain and the takeover of Cuba by the United States, which turned it into a virtual colony. Puerto Rico was taken over. Hawaii was stolen from its inhabitants by force and guile. The U.S. invaded the Philippines, killed probably a couple hundred thousand people, established a extensive system of control and domination, in many ways still exists. The U.S. was still not, it was by far the richest country in the world by then, but it was not the dominant force in global affairs. That was still Britain. That changed to some extent in the First World War, but changed dramatically in the Second World War. And by the end of the Second World War, the United States was in a position of just incomparable power, nothing like it in history. Had half the world's wealth, position of security with no parallel, no historical parallel. Industrial rivals were either destroyed or severely weakened. It was in a position really to run the world. And American planners knew it. Plans were laid during the Second World War. They were implemented shortly after the Second World War. A sophisticated, careful planning, which assigned every region of the world what was called its function. It's George Kennan's word, leading diplomat. Each part of the world has its function in the global system, dominated and controlled by the United States for the interests of domestic American power systems, of course. That was the peak of American power. Ever since 1945, the empire has been in decline. Now, that's become a fashionable topic in the last couple of years, but it's quite misleading if you think about it historically. The peak period of power was around 1945. And within a few years, there was a severe decline, and it was regarded that way. An event took place that's called in the United States the loss of China. Late 40s, China declared, moved on to independence. The phrase is interesting. The understanding was, we own China, and we lost it. And there's a big debate at the time, very bitter debate, continues to the present, about who's responsible for the loss of China. Well, that's the terminology alone is illustrative of the fundamental conception. We basically own the world, and if anybody moves towards independence, we're losing it, and somebody's responsible for the loss, and they're being aggressive, and we have to crush and somehow return them. Well, loss of China was serious. One part of major part of global planning after the Second World War was that the United States would have total control of the Far East, and China's a big part of it. Well, by the late 40s, that was over, and won't run through the details, but it's continued. Just in the last decade, South America, which was always regarded as the perfectly safe backyard, we just run it, no questions, has moved towards very significant independence. The first time in 500 years that South America's freed itself from significantly from Western control and has moved towards integration and even towards dealing with some of its very severe internal problems. Well, that's the loss of South America. The Arab Spring, if it could actually proceed without being beaten back, would mean the loss of the Middle East, which is a very serious matter. That's where, for the time being at least, the world's major energy resources are. It's always been a prime concern of post-war U.S. foreign policy to control the Middle East energy resources. And in general, the U.S. share of global wealth has declined. By about 1970, it had declined from roughly 50% to about 25%. That's still enormous, but it's not 50%. It incidentally remains at about that level. By 1970, the global system was becoming what's called tripolar, three major industrial areas, U.S.-based North America, mostly German-based Europe, and at that time, Japan-based Northeast Asia, which was already the most dynamic, growing part of the global economy. Well, by now it's not just Japan, it's China, it's South Korea, a rising industrial power, Taiwan, India's on the periphery. And there's a substantial growth of, it's becoming one of the major power centers. I think there's a lot of exaggeration of that, frankly. Kind of a corollary to the fashionable debate these days about the American decline is that the world's going to be taken over by China. But I don't think that's on the horizon. What's the growth of China in the last years has been pretty spectacular, and indeed there was plenty of growth before that, which isn't discussed much. But China remains a very poor country, facing severe internal problems that are unknown in the West, problems of all kinds, problems of poverty, of harsh repression, of ecological problems. It's not going to be easy to deal with these. But there has been spectacular economic growth, but to a large extent, not totally, but to a large extent, China remains a kind of an assembly plant. The exports from China are substantially based on imports, high-technology imports from the surrounding more advanced industrial societies, Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and indeed the West, like, you know, your Apple computers and so on. They may assemble them in Foxconn in Southeast China under horrendous conditions, but the technology, the software, the design, and so on, the sophisticated parts are coming from outside. Now, that's changing. China is moving up the technology ladder, and in some areas has done so very effectively, like the global market in solar panels is now dominated by China. I think they have over 50% of the market, and that includes the most advanced and sophisticated ones. The Chinese have understood something that the West ought to know from its own experience. A lot of innovation and development comes from manufacturing. What begins as low-level manufacturing provides techniques of design of work, control of work, technical innovation, and so on. And you know, anybody who works on his car in his garage knows that. And that's a lot of the way in which the industrial system developed, and that's how it's developing in China. They have taken over a lot of low-level manufacturing, but out of that come initiatives and ideas that can carry you up the ladder of innovation and development, and by now they're producing the most sophisticated solar panels, the highest technology. And sooner or later that may take place in other domains, but they've got a long way to go. The United States remains unique in its global power, though much weaker than before. The U.S. now, for example, may try to implement the policies carried over from the Second World War, and in fact it does try, but it has much less capacity to do so. You can see that all over, from South America to the Middle East to the Pacific, everywhere else. They're not giving up by any means. In fact, in many ways, U.S. power is extending. So, for example, if we go back to the late 40s, George Kennan, one of the leading planners, when he was parceling out the world and assigning each part its function, he was head of the State Department planning staff. When he got to Africa, it's kind of interesting to see what he wrote then. Internal secret documents at the time, they've been public for a long time. He wrote that the U.S. is not much interested in Africa. We don't have anything to gain there. So we'll hand it over to the Europeans to exploit, was his words, to exploit for their reconstruction. Mm. So you think about European-African relations over history, you can think of a slightly different relationship that might have been in order, but that wasn't even considered. So that was given to the Europeans to exploit for their reconstruction and also to give them a kind of a psychological lift since they were in bad shape. Well, that's changed. In recent years, the United States has recognized that it's got to enter the competition to control Africa because of its resources, and which are quite substantial, and many other things. And by now, the U.S. is expanding all over Africa. I don't know how many, probably dozens of military bases around Africa. There's a very, very good article about this just came out recently by Nick Terse, one of the best investigators, appeared in Tom Graham, find it on the Internet, in which he just reviewed the extensive development of intervention forces and bases and others all over Africa. Now, sometimes bits and pieces of this reach the public, so a couple of days ago, there was a news report about several American special forces operatives who were, I think, captured, maybe killed, I don't remember, in Mali. And the reason it became public was that they were found with a couple of prostitutes, so that made the news. But that's just an indication of what's going on all over Africa. Same's happening in South America. The United States has been expelled from all of its military bases in South America, but it's trying to restore them in various ways. Just recently, in the last couple of weeks, there was an agreement to develop some kind of military base. It's kind of under wraps, not clear, in Chile. And no doubt the U.S. is continuing to construct military bases in Colombia, even though the Colombian Constitutional Court has barred the United States from using the existing bases.
Noam, can I interrupt for 1 second? We've only got a couple minutes left, and I'd like to get one more caller in before we sign off. Let's go now to line 4, San Francisco. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Yes, hi. I'm calling from San Francisco. Noam, when you originally became active against the Vietnam War in the early 60s, you and friends of yours like Howard Zinn immediately came under surveillance. One of the responses of activists at that time was to form what were called affinity groups. Projecting forward, the Occupy movement is by the DHS and also local police authorities is coming under both physical surveillance and massive electronic surveillance. Do you have any suggestions for how Occupy movement members should respond to this? And the reason I'm asking is basically a tactical one. As Glenn Greenwald of Salon pointed out, this kind of surveillance frightens people who would otherwise be interested in engaging in protest activities or Occupy events and those kinds of things.
Caller, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you off because, we've only got about a minute at most for an answer.
The affinity groups were formed for a very good reason. Every activist group in the 60s very quickly discovered, if they hadn't been able to figure out before, that they're infiltrated. The state power doesn't look kindly on dissidents and activism, so you're always going to get infiltration. And pretty soon the groups were able to pick out the infiltrators. The guy who's dressed like a Hollywood version of a hippie and is shouting off the cops, he's likely to show up at the next court trial as a government witness. And when you were doing something serious, like I was involved in resistance activities, and when we were doing something where, lives were at stake, like helping a deserter get out of the country or something like that, we'd never do it within the organized groups, even though we all knew each other and trusted each other, because there was very likely an infiltrator there. So we would form affinity groups. People would just know each other very well.
On that note, Noam, I'm afraid I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio.
Okay.
I can't thank you enough for taking a time out of an hour out of your day on a Sunday to join us, Noam Chomsky. From the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for joining us and for the work you're doing.
Thanks a lot.
I want to thank Christina Williams, my producer, Kyle Kroha, my engineer. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with another show. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.